Welcome once again to our program, Interpreting the Bible Through the Ages. It's a new series, and we're on our 16th session of this new series about interpreting the Bible through the ages. As usual, our resident scholar is Ron Eldred, who teaches at John Paul II Catholic High School. He teaches religion, he teaches history, teaches apologetics and Bible. I'm your host, Monsignor Larry Moran, Pastor Emeritus at St. Patrick Catholic Church here at 19th and Poplar, where the Shamrock intersects the streets. Ron, we've been talking about, began a little bit on Immanuel Kant. And he has such a profound influence on philosophy and also on the interpreting of the Bible. Perhaps you could summarize just a little what we said in last program.
Well, what Kant was denying was that we can know anything with certainty that exists outside of our minds. As we're going to see when we get in further into our discussion, he called the real world outside of our minds the nominal world, and our perceptions of that world the phenomenal world. And the realist, and St. Thomas Aquinas, of course, was one of the most famous of all realists, all the way to include Aristotle, too, of course, whom he, of course, picked up on in the 13th century. They would argue there's a direct correspondence between what's out there and what's in the mind, that we can know that God created our senses in a way, our ability to see and to taste and to touch and to feel and all those kind of things. He created these senses so that we can know with a high degree of probability or certainty what really is outside of our minds. In other words, reality or truth. Kant was, of course, questioning that. In fact, we stopped yesterday, or our last session, with a quote here, and so I'll quote that again. That kind of brings home that point.
Sure.
One scholar has said that it was Kant who, more than anyone else, quote, sounded the death knell of realism, that is, our ability to know things outside of our minds, that there is a correspondence between what's outside of our minds and what's inside of our minds.
That's what he denied.
Okay. So, he sounded the death knell, of realism, the philosophy that there is a direct correspondence between what is in the mind and reality. By reality, meaning truth that exists outside the mind. With respect to the Bible, another scholar has said of him, quote, Immanuel Kant was the man who more than anyone else shifted the emphasis off the propositions of the Word of God, and by propositions here he's talking about doctrines for the
teachings.
Most part, teachings, yes. And he goes on to say, and onto man's reason. He effectively walled off God behind the unknowable realm of the nominal. Kant argued that we cannot know anything about the nominal realm, only the phenomenal. Now, we're going to explain these terms in some detail later on, so we won't try to go into that now.
All right.
He therefore made scientific naturalism the sphere of understanding. From this time on, many who would claim to be Bible scholars would adopt a hermeneutic, and by hermeneutic we mean the science of interpretation.
Good.
That would not fall out with Kant's critique. End of quote. And what he is, in effect, saying here is that almost all biblical scholars today are affected, or I might say, as I said, yes, in our last session, infected, either knowingly or unknowingly, with Kant's philosophy.
So he had a profound influence, and that's why we're spending more than a little time on Immanuel Kant. What does he mean by Kant's critique or analysis?
It's a book he wrote. It's called The Critique of Pure Reason. And he published it in 1781. Keep in mind now, Kant is a German, Lutheran in background, if I recall right. This is one of his two most famous works, the other being his The Critique of Practical Reason. It'll be important to know the distinction between those two books in the next session and a half or
okay.
So as we look at Kant.
One is the critique or the analysis of pure reason, the other the critique or the analysis of practical reason.
That's correct.
Okay.
Professor Borey, whom we quoted several times in our last session. He's a philosopher, a history of a historian of philosophy and psychology. He tells us by critique, Kant means, quote, a critical or careful analysis. And pure reason means reason which leads to knowledge that doesn't require experiential proof. By experiential, he's talking about experimentation, you know, the senses and what have you.
Anything we would learn from the outside.
Right. What is also called a priori, that's a Latin word, it just simply means beforehand knowledge.
Okay.
He says that Kant believed that humans not only possess knowledge from sense impressions, that is, from experience, but also have innate faculties of the mind, which synthesizes and organizes all sense experience through the concepts of time and space. According to Bori, the next step in the process of acquiring knowledge, and this is the way Kant looked at it, is what he called the transcendental analytic, which says that the mind applies certain innate categories of thought to ideas. Without these categories, Kant says, we would not be able to think at all. They are a priori, that is, they're pre-existing.
Would that be also like self-evident?
Yes, that would be very close to that.
Okay.
Or innate.
Okay.
That is, they exist prior to experience, and they help us organize our thoughts. In other words, if the human mind didn't have this kind of ability, in other words, it has to have the ability to process this raw data as it comes in from the outside into our through our senses into our mind. Whereas St. Thomas had 10 of these categories, Kant reduced them to 4, quantity, quality, relation, and modality. And it would be far beyond the scope of this series to discuss these any further, but we do examine St. Thomas's categories fairly carefully in my class on apologetics at John Paul II Catholic High School. What it really reduces down to, for those who've had a little bit of Thomistic or scholastic philosophy and theology, is a substance and accident. Okay. And accidents, of course, is broken into 9 other categories. So that's where Thomas gets these 10. And he actually took these from Aristotle. And Kant thought that was way too many, and so he reduced it to 4. But when you look at each of his 4, he has a lot of things subsumed under.
St. Thomas would have a real disagreement with Kant's conclusions.
Oh, certainly.
Okay.
The final step in the search for knowledge is what Kant called the transcendental dialectic, which means the mind seeks complete knowledge of things. But as we discussed, this is basically impossible because humans are capable of knowing only their own perceptions and thoughts, the phenomena. And are incapable of knowing things in themselves, the noumena. So as Bori says, quote, to discover that real world, we try to construct it by using our faculties of the mind. In other words, what we perceive as the real world is not the real world. It's something that's out there, and all this data streams, you know, through our senses and into our mind, which has these abilities. And then we construct reality. It's not reality in itself. We construct our own reality. And of course, it depends on how sane we are. It depends upon how intelligent we are. It depends upon how open-minded we are. All kinds of things as to what our ability is going to be in constructing reality.
So each person actually could interpret it differently.
You could have 10 people, and every one of them is going to have a different interpretation.
Okay.
Some of the interpretations, you know, most of the interpretations are going to be probably fairly close. Okay. Because most people are sane. most people have, a similar education and things of that sort. Another scholar said that Kant's system has no categories or organizing scheme that's innate, you know, in the mind, by which to receive data from the spiritual or the nominal world. He goes on to tell us, quote, in this way, humanity is like a blind man. He has no organ to receive the light which surrounds him. He believes that light exists and things are there to be seen, but he has no faculty by which to perceive it. Since he is blind to nominal reality, it is nominal, things outside your mind now, to nominal reality of all types, man cannot know the thing in itself. All that can be known is things as they are experienced, that is, as we construct them in the mind.
Boy, that that seems to me to be building on sand. Okay.
Well, Kant's method of arriving at his conclusions regarding the nominal and phenomenal as found in his Critique of Pure Reason is extremely technical, complex, and tedious, and far beyond the scope of this series, and I might add my own interest. But much of his effort is expended giving his explanation of the limitations of the senses in apprehending reality, that is, that which exists outside the mind. Because of the limitations of the senses, Kant concludes that humans can't know anything with certainty, and all we can know is representations of things in our minds, that we can have no direct knowledge of the things themselves. And, of course, that includes God. In other words, humans can only know things, and I put that "know" in big quotations, as they appear, as they are filtered through the senses, not a knowledge of things in themselves.
Okay.
It's important to hammer that home.
So Kant concludes that humans can't know anything with certainty.
That's outside their mind.
That's outside their mind. But I can know for certainty what is inside my mind.
But that's all we can know, though, is what's inside of our mind. And okay. the question is, does it correspond with what's outside the mind?
Okay.
Now, when we begin to apply this, it'll make more sense.
Okay, because it's really hard to follow from just a normal person's thinking. Okay, the terms nominal and phenomenal have come up several times, Ron. Let's say again, what do they mean so we can kind of focus on that?
By phenomenal is meant the world as we know it, as we perceive it, as it appears to us. The word phenomenon, or the plural phenomena, has been defined as observable or perceived facts. I remember learning that many, many years ago in a science class.
Okay.
The phenomenal world is the world as we perceive it, as we see it, smell, taste, hear, and feel it. And on the other hand, the nominal world is the world as it exists in itself, apart from our knowledge of it. It's the world of things as they really exist outside of our minds and perceptions. All of our listeners have probably heard the old story about if a tree falls in the forest, if there's no one there to hear it, did it really happen? You know, did it really exist? Did it exist, you know, beyond our senses? John Young, who is a leading Australian catechist and philosopher, says of Kant's thought, quote, "The things which affect our senses are totally unknown as they are in themselves," end of quote. And he goes on to say, Kant believed that, quote, "we have a power of understanding which is fed by the senses, but it, like the senses, is so constructed that it confers meaning on the things presented to it," end of quote. In other words, we construct our own reality with our faculties of the mind using the data provided by our senses. And as a consequence, Young states that, quote, "Kant's doctrine shuts us up in a world of our own, a world we ourselves constructed. So far as our speculative intellect is concerned, the old arguments for God's existence, the soul's immortality, free will, are all invalid. For they suppose knowledge of noumena, that is, things in themselves," end of quote. And I would say, in other words, God is a noumena. He's a thing in himself. According to Kant's view, then, he can't be known, with any degree of certainty because he exists outside of our minds.
Okay, now, help me here a moment. It sounds like the definition, popularly, of insanity, when I lose contact with reality.
Well, that's what you would say. That's why we define sanity, or someone who's sane who has a contact with reality. And an insane is a person, of course, who doesn't have contact with reality. And that's why I used the example a while ago of a sane person.
Okay.
A sane person, I don't think Kant is going so far as to say we're all insane, though.
Okay.
Just because we can't know what's out of our side of our minds with any degree of certainty. And he and as you're going to see, when he gets into his critique of practical reason, he's trying to find a way around this.
Okay.
In other words, I think Kant saw that, hey, I've destroyed this whole system, this whole way that they looked at things for 2,000 years, or 1800 years.
So he comes back and starts thinking about how to deal with the normal problems.
The real world.
Real world.
In fact, one scholar put it somehow. See, how did it go? Kant shut out with in the front door, he let in the back door, or something like that.
Clever statement.
So we're getting to that.
Okay.
In other words, Kant did believe that we can know that God exists.
Okay.
But not the traditional intellectual way, not the rational way that had been used, you know, for so many centuries.
Okay.
One scholar has written that the nominal world, quote, is a totally unstructured world to which human knowledge has no access whatsoever. I do not discover the world as the realists maintain. I invent it. End of quote. Then he goes on to quote the famous realist philosopher Alfred North Whitehead as saying of this 18th century idealism, Kant's philosophy, quote, Kant's philosophy has held its own as the guiding principle of scientific studies ever since. This is Whitehead quoting now. It is still reigning. Every university in the world organizes itself in accordance with it. No alternative system of organizing the pursuit of scientific truth has been suggested. It is not only reigning, but it is without a rival, and yet it is quite unbelievable, end of quote.
Wow.
Father John Hardin, one of the world's leading catechists and theologians until his death in 2000, in his Modern Catholic Dictionary says that idealism is the theory of modern philosophy that, quote, denies reality to the external physical world and attributes real existence only to things as they are in the mind. In its extreme form, it is a pure subjectivism, denying existence to anything outside the mind of the thinking persons, end of quote. Going back to Whitehead, he's saying that Kant's idealism is the dominant way that scientists and scholars look at reality and knowledge, and I might add most biblical scholars today, including many, if not most Catholic ones.
Okay, so it's seeped into the major thinking of intellectuals of our society.
Well, Kant called everything in the nominal world transcendental because even though it exists, it can't be registered and experienced. You know, see, Kant wasn't denying that things exist outside the mind. He was just simply saying is that we just simply don't have the ability to know it directly.
Okay. Like a blind man, as you mentioned earlier, who knows there's light out there, but he can't see it.
Or we could know that God's out there, but you can't see God or feel God or something of that sort.
Okay.
In other words, you can't directly experience it.
All right.
What he's saying is that the nominal world transcends or is beyond human experience.
Okay.
For us to know things, we must first experience them, and according to Kant, experience is structured by our minds. Things in themselves must be turned into the world of experience. And this means that things in themselves, what are called objects, always remained outside the realm of knowledge. All we humans can know is our own conscious constructions of objects. We can't know the objects in themselves. We can only know our own thoughts. Consequently, things as they are in themselves, that is, the nominal world or unknowable, including God's existence and his revelation as found in the Bible. Of course, I am here speaking only of knowledge acquired through the senses. As we shall see, Kant believed that there were other ways to acquire knowledge of God and other things.
Okay, well, that's a very fine distinction. I mean, a very careful distinction.
Well, otherwise, he's got it shut off. There's one of our scholars that we quoted, there's a wall there, mm-hmm. and we couldn't function very well if we didn't have some practical way of getting through the world day by day.
Okay. Well, Ron, then what consequences does Kant's thinking have for interpreting the Bible, which is the title of this series, Interpreting the Bible Through the Ages? He apparently had a profound influence.
Well, Kant's idea that we can never know for certain that anything exists outside of our minds and senses rules out proof of God's existence and of his revelation as found in the Bible, as well as knowledge of the immortality of souls. As David McKee says in his The Story of Philosophy, quote, "It is important to realize that Kant's system does not rule out the existence of God, only knowledge of the existence of God." As he famously put it, he had ruled out knowledge in order to make room for faith. This aspect of his philosophy has been of historic importance. He demolished so-called proofs of the existence of God, and in doing so reduced to rubble much of the philosophizing of centuries, if not of millennia. Since Kant, it has been accepted almost universally by serious thinkers that the existence of God is not something that can be proved, or for that matter, disproved. Kant brings up the question, if God in his revelation is part of the nominal world or mode of existence, that is, it exists outside the mind, then how can humans know anything about him and his attributes with any degree of certainty? And the Catholic Church, of course, has always had a satisfactory answer to this question with the scholastic philosophy of realism. But as we have seen in earlier sessions of this series, Descartes and Kant's rationalism challenged and attempted to demolish the scholastic view. Father Hardin defines realism, to jog our memories here, as, quote, "every form of philosophy that recognizes, one, the objective existence of God and the world of their various relationships independently of human knowledge and desire, two, that these things are knowable as they are in themselves," that is, we can know God in himself and what he really is like. Father Robert O'Donnell states in his Hooked on Philosophy, Thomas Aquinas Made Easy, although it's not very easy if you read the book, that realists, including St. Thomas Aquinas, start out with the fact that all knowledge begins with sense experience, added to the fact that the human mind naturally links effects with their causes. There we're going, you know, to Hume's, what Hume denied, that this would be possible. Kant applied his idealist philosophy to many different subjects, including the field of faith and morals. And although although we can't go into his logical reasoning, he argued that God is an object that can never be known. He not only denied that any logical proof of God was possible, but, quote, he went further and asserted that no logical proof should be possible. If the human will is truly free and unfettered, then belief in God should never be a compulsion of logic.
So he accepts the existence of God, but that we cannot achieve it by reason or revelation.
Right.
But he accepts it and continues to work from that premise that we achieve it in a different way, which we're going to talk about later.
Yes, and in fact, the reason it's important is because when we get into some of the Protestant German, especially German Protestant philosophers and scripture scholars in the 18th or the 19th and 20th centuries, you're going to see that they basically use Kant's method. In fact, I think it opens the door to what we call modernism that we're going to be getting into later.
Which was such a major problem for the church.
And we'll have cause to mention that a little bit before we get through with Kant even.
Okay. Well, I think you had a few more things you wanted to say, or can I give you another question?
Well, I think I'm ready for another question now.
Okay. What did he mean when he said that belief in God should never be a compulsion of logic, like it makes us a slave or something if we reason to something?
Well, what Kant was rejecting was the logical method of the scholastics of proving God's existence, because their method started starting with nature, and which of course exists outside of the mind, and then reasoning by logic to proof of God's existence, something that St. Paul had said that we can do. In other words, we can look at the beauty of God's existence and we can reason from that there is a God. Kant would argue that because that's outside of our minds, then of course we can't do that. It's impossible to do that.
Okay.
I must add, in fairness to Kant, he was not trying to destroy traditional religion, as was Spinoza. He, like Descartes, was trying to save it by giving a totally rational basis for, you know, knowing religion and knowing about God. In this regard, he said, quote, this is Kant, quoting from Kant. Of course, he wrote in German, so this is a translation.
Okay.
I inevitably believe in the existence of God and in a future life. And I am certain that nothing can shake this belief, since my moral principles would thereby themselves be overthrown. And I cannot disclaim them without becoming abhorrent in my own eyes. End of quote. John Young, remember he's the philosopher and catechist from Australia we quoted a while ago, says that from this, Kant concluded that morality based on God's law does exist. That, quote, they cannot be logically proved, but his experience of the moral law within himself guarantees their reality, end of quote. Paradoxically, contrary to their intention, both Descartes and Kant ended up creating philosophical systems that destroyed faith for millions of people over the ages, including many scripture scholars, I might add.
Well, isn't it true that Kant was influenced by the Pietism, which was so prevalent in the day? And maybe you better say a moment of what Pietism is.
Well, I understand that he was influenced very much so by this, and it was a movement in the Lutheran Church in the early 19th century, even started back in the 18th century, that emphasized a religion of the Bible and of the heart, as opposed to a religion of doctrines and the intellect. And the roots of both Moravian and Methodist churches are found in Pietism. John Wesley, of course, who was the founder of the Methodist Church, was very much influenced by the Moravian Brethren. Kant and Friedrich Schleiermacher, whom we will look at soon, we're going to spend a session on him because he was so important, but he was heavily influenced by Kant and, of course, by Pietism. And I think that it's fairly easy to see why religion of the heart, that is emotions and feelings and intuition and that kind of thing, would be more satisfactory to Kant than religion of the intellect, because he's really not denying that we can know God with the intellect. So he's going to get around to trying to prove that how we can know God, you know, with the heart. And if you know anything about modernism, and right on down to the present day, that should become very evident, and we'll trace that through, though.
Okay, Ron, I'm sorry, but our time has run out. To our audience, we say may God bless you always and in all ways.